If it please court, Charles Torres on behalf of the plaintiffs, Jeff Lee, James Lee, and Front Range Surgical Specialist. This matter comes before the court on a second appeal. The issues that are remaining in terms of claims are defamation, invasion of privacy, interference with contract. There are two claims, claim six that deals with ratification, or there's one claim that deals with ratification that involves what has been identified as the dismissed defendants. Taking the issues that we have, that I have raised, or the plaintiffs have raised in order, we submit that the plaintiff, or that the court, district court, committed error in dismissing claim three because it mixed up a very separate specific claim two in terms of trying to decide whether or not a claim is made out under claim three, interference with contract, that dealt with three doctors who came together in plaintiff's, based on plaintiff's position, defamed, interfered with plaintiff's privacy outside of the peer review process, and that that particular claim or that particular action by these three individuals immediately caused Dr. Melman, who was an employee of Banner, to cause Banner to force Dr. Lee to refrain from doing Traumacol, which led to the destruction of plaintiff's very small surgical practice involving two brothers, Jeff Lee and James Lee, and their, and obviously their clinic at the same time. Judge Moss made a ruling that was very specific on claim two when he dismissed our breach of contract claim. It was based upon the claim that Banner, we thought, wrote into the agreement with the Lees, an agreement that the bylaws would come in and protect these individuals if an event like this came about. That is what the subject of claim number two is. Claim number three was dealt with the action that occurred before. That is, Dr. Frazier, Dr. Burton, and Dr. Melman created bogus claims, took them to Melman, who then went outside of the peer review process and caused the termination of Dr. James Lee from the practice. Our point has been, and I think the district court understood it, our claim in claim two was to ask for protection once this other problem had happened. So I'm submitting that we could have maybe filed two or three different breaches of contract claims against Banner, but we only chose one, and we chose to direct it at what we thought was in the contract between Banner and the doctors.
Before the lower court, were you relying on Restatement Section 766, which requires a breach, Section 766A, which is more in the context of interfering with performance, or did you raise both before the lower court?
No, to answer your question, no, I didn't raise either of those specific points, either restatement, as the court is asking the question. What I did raise, and I think the court addressed it very specifically, was just the issue of whether we could have some protection based upon our agreement with Banner, based on what happened before in reference to Melman, Frazier, and Burton taking actions against my client, and based on bogus claims, causing them to terminate. And that's why we needed the protection from Banner. So that's why we filed claim number two. And that is breach contract. We said, what are you doing here? You should have been helping us out based on what we thought you promised it. Judge Moss said, look, I can't find any kind of language where Banner promised you those kind of protections.
My question wasn't claim two. My question was claim three. In other words, in your tortious interference claim, as you argued it to the lower court, were you asserting that there was a breach and therefore tortious interference, which would be under 766, or were you asserting that the defendant simply made it impossible or difficult for your clients to perform the contract, which would be 766A?
The former, Your Honor.
So you argued a breach?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Under principles of collateral estoppel or res judicata, why are you entitled to proceed for purposes of claim two under a different type of breach than the court resolved against you for purposes of claim two, and you didn't appeal that resolution?
Well, because interference with contract under the four elements does not require that I raised a separate, different contract issue with Banner. I that's the reason we did it the way we did, and that's why we didn't appeal the breach contract issue, because as it was addressed by Judge Moss, it was clearly whether or not we had some sort of protection from the action taken earlier by these other doctors against our doctors. That's why I proceeded the way I did. And I don't see, I couldn't find any cases, and as Venice didn't find any cases, that stated that that was not a permissible way to proceed. If claim two would have addressed what we addressed in claim three, then I could see the argument.
So, Mr. Torres, in claim three, the nature of the breach by Banner was what?
Was Dr. Mellon, their employee, going outside of the peer review process, because that was something we had to have based on the last appeal, going outside of the peer review process and causing this particular problem for Dr. James Lee. In other words, immediately causing Banner, through Dr. Mellon, to tell Dr. James Lee, you can no longer perform under the agreement. That's what the breach was, in our opinion.
So the three defendants communicated to Mellon false accusations. Mellon then took an action to demand that Lee
refrain immediately,
and that request by Mellon and that confrontation with Mellon, that was a breach.
Sure, yes, because okay. Mellon is an employee who can also be held liable for interference of contract, you know, based on the case law I read. That's the breach that I saw was separate from claim two.
So the agreement that he was breaching then was that there was an agreement that he would provide trauma services, and the request, demand, however you phrase it, was that you not provide those services.
And that's correct. That's Mellon's response based on bogus claims.
And Banner was obligated to allow him to do that, to not allow Mellon, but to allow Lee to provide trauma services. Yes, that was their agreement.
That was the basic agreement. Claim two adds something that we thought was also there to help maybe protect us based on what happened to us.
Mr. Torres, let me just ask a point of clarification here. You're referring to claim two being breach of contract and claim three being tortious interference with contract. And I wanted to ask, are you also asserting anything about claim four? Because as I read that in the complaint, that also addresses tortious or intentional interference with contract. Is that part of your argument today or not?
Well, yes, it is, to the extent that claim four, which has defamation plus interference with contract, that sort of mirrors claim three, because in both those claims, we're saying that the defamation, invasion of privacy that involved Mellon and company, if you will, did create the interference contract. So it goes with three. It certainly does not go with two, if that's what the court is asking me.
Well, I'm also asking about claim four. Is that part of your argument today? Was that a claim that was dismissed? And is that part of your argument now, or are you only talking about claim three?
No, in reference to this claim three versus two, I'm only really referring to claim three and two, and I'm not necessarily adding in claim, the interference with contract in claim four. I'm just saying that's consistent with it. Okay. The second issue that came up before the court is, and I think this is probably going to have to be one of first impression, based on Melcher versus Beeler, 1910 case, which I think is well discussed by the court. I think it had a good conclusion, and that is that Dr. Jeff Lee and the clinic did not have to be named in the defamatory statement by Banner in order to have a cause of action for defamation and invasion of privacy. In Beeler, or in Melcher versus Beeler, in that particular case, it was a partnership. Only Mr. Melcher was named in the defamatory language, but the court found where the group is that small that both of the partners and the company could bring an action. I also cited a New York case, which also talked, I thought, very distinctly to the issue that where the class is defamed is so small that the immediate identification of each member reasonably follows that provides a cause of action in a small group of people. In this particular case, we have two brothers, same initials. When people hear about Front Range Surgical Specialists, it's pretty hard for these potential patients to probably distinguish between James and Jeff.
Excuse me.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
What exactly, as specific as you can, is the defamatory utterance that you're attributing to Melman?
Okay. That Dr. Lee's medical treatment of patients was so extreme and so dangerous that he had to be immediately stopped from proceeding with any kind of surgical practice.
Okay, so Melman, in the presence of third parties, specifically said, you're incompetent, basically.
Yes, and obviously it's in the context of, in the context of his personal confrontation with James Lee, that's what he told him. Not in those words, but in
well, that's what I want to focus on.
Yeah, in angry words, he told him, if you even try to go ahead and proceed, if you don't refrain from Tramacol, we will have to take immediate action against you. And that was done in front of other people.
Excuse me, though. What I'm trying to distinguish is between the part of the defamatory utterance you just paraphrased and what you said a couple minutes earlier, which was accusing Dr. Lee of not properly treating his patients. Now, was there a specific statement by Melman to Lee in the presence of third parties that you're not properly rendering proper medical care?
Yes, there was. There was language. And actually, the conversation was recorded. And that, what I think the language that you're probably asking about is that you are a danger and we need to do something about it. The problem with Melman is he knew very little about the basis for why these complaints were being made against Dr. Lee.
Well, the dangerous statement was made, and that's the basis for the defamation.
Yes, that's certainly part of it, Judge.
And that's in the record. That statement is in the record.
Yes, I believe it is. It's probably in the trial record. It's also in the depositions that were taken of Dr. James Lee in terms of what the conversations were. And I guess I better move very quickly through the rest of this. The third issue is the statute of limitation issue. And I think probably the court from the briefs can figure that one out, whichever way you decide to go on it. But our basically position is either they didn't get the answer filed for 5 years and the defense was not raised, when they clearly knew that we had a statutory, we had a 2 points in time that had statutes of limitations issues. They just totally ignored it. They didn't file any motions either before the appeal or after. And as I've indicated, for all those different reasons, when they knew that there was potential defense there, they should have raised it one way or the other, and they can't be coming back after appeal and getting a second bite of the apple and then raising it right before trial, 2 weeks before trial, which really created a problem for us, as I indicated in our brief, because at that point in time, once those two claims were knocked out, it made it very difficult to show the pattern of what occurred on January 23rd the following year. So it did have a very prejudicial effect from that standpoint. The next issue, excluding evidence, I think that's an interesting one for the court. I know Judge Lichtenstein was on the previous appeal in this case. But as I understand the court's ruling in that particular case, if you have defamation outside the peer review, then that doesn't have to be taken in front of the CAC. Defense argues that because it was an exhaustion of remedy, a jurisdictional issue, that somehow that prevents us from having the evidentiary value of information in the peer review, which will contradict the defamatory statements that were made outside. I think the Brown case and the other case that plaintiffs cited in that case talk to the issue why it's important. They should not be able to go outside of the peer review process, which is protected by confidentiality, and then when somebody calls them on it, say, well, wait a minute, you can't have that information that will show that there was a defamatory statement made out of the peer review. You can't use it both as a shield and a sword. So that's the important point, I think, from that case. The Ozier case, I look at it as the Ozier case, but the other issue, I think the judge acted as finder of fact. As we indicate, the jury was very aware during voir dire how this could possibly affect a doctor in this particular case. Maybe that's an anecdotal point, but the point is, I think Ozier was very broad. It's not a question of, okay, you just had a letter stamped confidential, we didn't know what was in it. That's not the point. All the cases I read, including the cases that were cited by the defense, deal with the manner and the purpose. We had a special audience. is this doctor was just about to go into surgery, and in that particular case, all the stuff is spelled out. So that letter with confidentiality was now turned into a freak show, a circus, in terms of what they wanted to get across. And we had this happen on three different occasions, and each one of them was in the context of this doctor's medical competence. Judges, I'm sorry, I'm out of time, so would I appreciate the time?
May it please the court, Stu Steller of Kaplan and Ernest. I'm here on behalf of most of the appellees. Defendants seated with me at council table is Carrie Hershey, who's here on behalf of Dr. Les Frazier and Dr. Rick Kaiser, and also Jennifer Hunt, who's here on behalf of Dr. Lisa Burton. To be honest, there were several issues that were raised in the complaint, but I think the overriding concern for the court is whether or not the plaintiffs were given a fair opportunity to pursue the claims that this court remanded. Those claims, as Mr. Torres has said, there's three different claims that who's the plaintiff and who's the defendant for those claims vary a little bit, but it's a defamation claims, invasion of privacy, that is public disclosure of private facts, and then the intentional interference with contract claims. Those are the three substantive claims that were remanded. I think those issues are dealt with fairly squarely in the briefs. I'll touch upon those only briefly, and then I want to focus on the attorney's fees issue because I think that is an area where there is room for some confusion. With respect to the intentional interference with contract, you were asked how was the contract violated. The contract, the response was that Dr. Melman went outside the peer review process. That is specifically the allegation of the breach of contract claim that's cited in the complaint. If you turn to the breach of contract claim, you'll see that there are something like 8 or 9 paragraphs, one which has about 7 subparagraphs describing the nature of the breach of the contract. It covered the universe. That claim was dismissed. His counsel has conceded that they are proceeding under the element that required proof of a breach of the contract, and there was no breach as a matter of law. With respect to the defamation issue being attributed to from one brother to another, the reality is the statute of limitations would apply to both brothers' defamation claims, and that really boils down to an abuse of discretion standard, that is whether or not the court abused its discretion in entertaining those defenses because they're in an answer that they assert was untimely, and the court said, I'm going to allow that in. There was no motion for default judgment. There was no motion to strike the answer. There was no motion to strike the defenses in the answer. Certainly, it is not an abuse of discretion to entertain those defenses in that context. With respect to the attorney's fees issue, we know that 1317.201 requires an award of attorney's fees anytime a defendant is dismissed from a case pursuant to a Rule 12 motion, regardless of whether the case goes on with respect to other defendants and other claims. The district court entered an award of attorney's fees on behalf of 4 defendants: the CEO of Northern Colorado Medical Center, Gene O'Hara; the CEO of Banner Health, Peter Fine; the Banner Health Board of Directors, named individually as John Doe's 1 through 12, and the Banner Health Appellate Review Committee. If you look at the complaint, you'll see that those 4 defendants are mentioned only in the 6th claim for relief. That is the claim for the ratification and approval of the allegedly flawed peer review process and for a failure to conduct an independent investigation, which also is tied up with the peer review process. That claim, like all the claims, was subject to the first motion to dismiss that came before this court. This court affirmed that dismissal with respect to all claims that had to do with peer review process.
Mr. Stoller, let me ask you, that claim, claim 6, was it dismissed on stipulation or was it dismissed on a 12B?
Stipulation is not an accurate way to put it, Your Honor. When this court remanded back to the district court asked the parties, to provide position statements about what claims and defendants were still left in the case. The position statement submitted by the plaintiffs gave a list of defendants that they believe were still in the case. That list did not include Mr. Fine, Mr. O'Hara, the Appellate Review Board, or the Board of Directors. We, in our position statement, interpreted that to mean that they recognized, that they stipulated that that sixth claim was gone. It had been disposed of by the initial motion to dismiss. And that's the way that we phrased it for the court, and we said if that's the case, then they should prepare a stipulation for dismissal of that claim. They never did. Therefore, we had to file a motion for entry of judgment. This was not a new motion to dismiss. This was not a new motion for judgment on the pleadings. It was a motion for entry of judgment based upon this court's decision with respect to the first motion to dismiss. And ruling on that motion, the court found, and this is on page 1667 of the record, the court finds that defendants Gene O'Hara, Peter S. Smith, Banner Health Board of Directors, Banner Health Appellate Review Committee, and members of Banner Health Board of Directors, John Doe's 1 through 12, should be dismissed as defendants in this matter since the remaining claims, defamation, intentional interference, invasion of privacy, do not include specific allegations against these defendants. That meant that that claim died with respect to the first motion to dismiss. They were excused from this case as a result of a motion to dismiss. 13-17-201 requires that they be given an award of attorney's fees. To be honest, the only other arguments that they make with respect to that attorney's fees issue, aside from the stipulation argument, is that the claims of Jeff Lee and Front Range Surgical Services were dismissed pursuant to a Rule 12C motion. That's not historically accurate. Again, they were dismissed pursuant to this motion for entry of judgment, not pursuant to the 12C motion. In addition, as a practical matter, a 12C motion is the functional equivalent of a 12B5 motion, and there's really no reason to treat one differently from the other when they are the functional equivalents. Your Honors, if there are no other questions, I would ask that you affirm the district court's decision in all respects. Thank you.
We appreciate the arguments of counsel. The case stands submitted. Counsel are excused. We'll issue a written opinion in due course.